Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. There have been few singers more passionate about their band and their art than my guest this week. As the leader and driving force behind Dexys Midnight Runners, he led the group to massive success with classic singles like Gino, Come On Eileen, and the one you've just heard, There There My Dear. Dexys imploded in 1986 under the weight of his refusal to compromise at any costs, but he oversaw the band's revival in 2012 for an album and a series of live shows that were greeted with almost religious fervour by fans and critics. My guest this week on The First Time is Kevin Rowland. Here Kevin looks back over his life, looking at how a passion for music provided an escape from his rough and difficult upbringing in Wolverhampton and his deep, almost spiritual connection with music. He also recalls his triumphs and failures with Dexys, from Come On Eileen to the commercial and critical failure of their 1985 record Don't Stand Me Down, a record that's now revered as something of a masterpiece. This is all the more special as Kevin rarely discusses the past. So it's also fitting that we discuss the band's comeback, his refusal to join the nostalgia circuit, and how his belief in the power of music has never dimmed. But I started by asking Kevin, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
I can remember singing it and singing songs and hearing songs when I was about two, three. And my favourite song, which I learned when I was about three, was... Well, I don't know what it's called. I think The Happy Wanderer it's called. No, it's not. Anyway, it goes, I'm a rambler, I'm a gambler, I'm a long way from home. And if you don't like me, then leave me alone. I eat when I'm hungry, I drink when I'm dry, and if the moonshine don't kill me, I live till I die. And that's all I knew. I need to sing that over and over. And then I found out later it's a country and western thing. It would be, wouldn't it, with the moonshine?
So. That's quite a poetic start to your musical love affair.
I suppose it is, yeah.
I'm a rambler, I'm a gambler, I'm a long ways from home, and if you don't like me, well, leave me alone. I'll eat when I'm hungry, and I'll drink when I'm dry, and if moonshine don't kill me, I live till I die.
What were the first artists that you can remember kind of hearing around the house and stuff when you were growing up, that you remember sort of identifying as being, oh, that's that singer or she's that performer?
It's hard for me to think of anybody before Elvis, you know, but I remember, you know, seeing pictures of him even before I'd heard his music, and because he didn't have a record player.
What do you think of the pictures? Were they?
I just thought he looked stunning. Yeah, from about 6, 7, looked fantastic. He's like so full of love, and so then I just wanted to hear the music, and when I started to hear the music, I really liked it. I'd heard people talking about it before I heard it, and then heard the music, yeah.
What effect did that have on you?
Well, it was almost like a religion, because I thought he was like a god. He just looked like a god, sounded like a god, and he was this singing of this other world, you know, just sounded amazing, compared with Park Street South in Blakenhall in Wolverhampton, which was bombed. You know, it was like loads of old derelict buildings around, and I mean, it wasn't a slum, but it was a very ordinary area, you know.
What's the Elvis track we should play at this juncture, then?
Can't Help Falling in Love.
Why that song?
Well, I just heard that, and I just was knocked out by it, and I was 8. And it was my birthday when it was out, so I was getting money for my birthday, and I thought, I'm going to buy that record. And it was just so beautiful. It was number one. I'd been looking at it in the record shop. And the record shops in those days didn't only sell records, they sold Hoovers, all kinds of other stuff. Well, the one I went to, anyway. And they had a little rack of singles, and it would have number one, number two, number three, number four. And I'd be looking at this before it was my birthday, when I knew I was going to be getting the money, and looking at number one, and it was there. And then when I went down to buy it with my 6 and 8, it wasn't there. That number one bit of the rack was empty, but the number two rack had this song called Whim Away, and I didn't know what, by Carl Denver, which is The Lion Sleeps Tonight, basically. And I didn't know what to do. And I felt so disappointed. But no, they've all gone, mate. No more Can't Help Falling in Love. They're all gone. So I didn't, it was a stupid thing that I did, but that's what you do when you're 8. I was disappointed. So I bought bloody Carl Denver's Whim Away. And I brought it home. And my dad went, what did you buy that bloody thing for? It's not even in English. You can't even understand it. But, you know, I still loved Elvis. I would bunk into the cinemas and watch his films. You know, Kid Galahad, where he was a boxer.
Yeah.
Just loved him.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you. Shall I stay? Would it be if I can't help falling in love with you? Like a river flows surely to the sea, darling, so it goes. Some things are meant to be. For I can't
so it goes. Some things are meant to be. Take my hand, take my whole life too, for I can't help falling in love with you, for
had, I think it's fair to say, a spiritual connection to music. You've always seen it as this force. Do you think that is in part down to, you say, coming from like a pretty rough background, that it represented like this is escape, this is a different world that you can get to maybe?
I definitely saw it as another world, you know, that they were singing about something that I'd never heard before, but it just looked amazing and I wanted to be in it. And from that age, I just wanted to be a singer.
Who did you want to be, apart from Elvis?
I mean, I wanted to be any of them. Cliff, you know, any of them.
What was the first gig that you went to, can you remember?
The very first one I went to, I don't know I suppose it was a gig, was in Wolverhampton. I was in the Cubs, and for somewhere or other, how or other, they had a band on at this do. It must have been a do with loads of other things apart from the Cubs, but we were there as Cubs, and there was a local band who were probably attached to the church in some way, because there was a lot of activity around the church, and they were called Giorgio and the Marksmen.
Not a bad name,
Not a bad name. They were all Italian. There was a lot of Italians in Wolverhampton, and they kind of looked cool. They were a bit like Wolverhampton's version of Cliff and the Shadows, but they looked great. They had the suits. They had the equipment. So I was up there staring at the equipment, looking at them, looking at their suits, watching them set up, then watching them perform. Magical.
Album, first album, that's a different thing again, because you've got a body of work then, haven't you? You've got a world you can really enter when you play. What was the first record that you bought that really made an impact on you like that?
Right, I bought some Motown compilations, but they don't really count. They were like Chartbusters Volume 3, Volume 8. But the first time was summer of 72, 18. I worked at Butlin's for the summer.
How was that?
Great. First time away from home. You know, great fun. Amazing. And I met all kinds of different kinds of people that I hadn't really met before. I came in contact with a lot of students, and I knew about their world, long hair, and they used to sort of carry albums under their arm, and they had a kind of an intellectual thing, which I sort of half respected, but didn't really want to be into that. And then I met these Scouse kids who were kind of working class, but they also had long hair. And they were into some of these artists that these other student-y ones were into, but they were just much more relaxed about it. They would roll a joint, but believe it or not, in those days, people who smoked dope were kind of, you know, like this big, like, ceremony, and these Scousers were just rolling them up, and they had a completely much more relaxed attitude to everything. Anyway, they were going on about Dylan. They were massively into Dylan. They weren't pretentious, where the kids in Harrow, where I was living by now since I was 11, they were kind of pretentious about it. If they were into Hendrix, or they would sort of put you off it because they were kind of, I don't know, they just put me off, really. Didn't want to have their lifestyle. But these guys got me into Dylan, and they had a little cassette player or whatever, and they were playing Dylan, and I got to like it. And then I bought Blonde on Blonde, and I thought that was an amazing album, and I couldn't believe that one of the tracks, Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, was one complete side of vinyl, but it carried it. So that was great. More mystery there, I found, and magic.
With your mercury mouth in the missionary times, and your eyes like smoke, and your prayers like rhymes, and your silver cross, and your voice like chimes. Oh, who do they think could bury you? With your pockets well protected at last, and your streetcar visions which you place on the grass, and your flesh like silk, and your face like glass. Who could they get to carry you? Sad eyed lady of the lowlands, where the sad eyed prophet says that no man comes. My warehouse has my Arabian drums. Should I put them by your gate? Oh, sad eyed lady, should I wait? With your sheets like metal and your belt like lace and your deck of cards missing the jack and the ace and your basement clothes and your hollow face. Among them didn't think he could outguess you with your silhouette when the sunlight dims into your eyes where the moonlight swims and your matchbook song and your gypsy hymns, who among them would try to impress you?
So what about when punk first hit? Did you get it straight away? Did you
straight away?
Yeah?
Yeah.
What was the band for you?
It was the fashion first, to be honest. It was the fashion that got me into it first, because I was already into Roxy and Bowie, and which were a lot of the original punks were. And I was already kind of wearing sometimes 60s clothes, even before I heard punk, a leather jacket, tight jeans, you know, James Dean haircut. And I was already in a band. I was already starting to play music myself by this point. It was already at that stage, like, their competitors, what are they doing? Well, I heard Anarchy in the UK, right, in the Romulus in Birmingham. Everybody there was Roxy, Bowie, which was the most interesting thing going on by far. And they'd play a bit of that, and everyone would be dancing. And then they played November 76, whatever it was, just after it was released, Anarchy in the UK. Everybody danced, everybody loved it, so it was a moment, that was it. There was another really interesting moment, which is not that pleasant, but at the time, when I look back, I don't really like it, but at the time, it felt incredibly significant. About 6-9 months later, middle of 77, the Clash was supposed to play in Birmingham, but it was cancelled for some reason. The council wouldn't allow it. And they all came up anyway. The rumour was they were coming up anyway. And there was going to be a party in Barbarella's, which was the local club. And there was a party in the side room, and the Clash were there, and loads of people were there, and we were all just sitting around and listening to records. And then the rumour got round, because there was a main band, there was like a rock band playing in the main hall of Barbarella's, and the rumour got round that the Clash were going to play. So everybody steamed in to the main room, all the punks. And this big rock band were in full flow, but there was hardly anybody watching them until all the punks came in. First of all, the rock band thought, oh, great, everybody's here for us. And you could tell them they were singing to these, hey, how's it going, and like that, and really, really trying to play to this big throng at the front. But pretty soon, the throng at the front was trying to get the equipment off and were pulling the microphone lead. And the first thing singer was, thought that's a joke, and smiling, thought they were really enthusiastic. But what they were trying to do was get the equipment off them. And that's what they did. They literally, the fans just pulled it off them, and then they disappeared. They went off stage, and some kind of deal must have been done where they allowed the Clash to use their instruments. And that's exactly what happened. This poor old rock band got paid off, and the Clash came on. And using their instruments, did their music, did their set. And it was mean, but it was a moment. It was a moment where you thought, wow, change.
When did you first... I hate the word concept, but the concept for Dexys then?
Well, I was in this band called Lucy and the Lovers, which was inspired by Deaf School and Roxy Music. We wore makeup and blah, blah, blah. And as we were rehearsing, punk started happening. And by the time we started doing gigs, there was punks everywhere. So we changed. We thought we'd change and we'll try and fit in with what's going on. And we became the Killjoys. And it was an awful band. We were like a third division punk band, really. I was just hating it, really. And during that, I thought, you know what? I want to play soul music. I just, so one day I just thought, I want to play bloody soul music. I don't want to do this.
Just one day, like,
yeah. I just thought, I want to play something with soul in it. And I think people are going to want to dance. This is, you know. And I just had that idea. But I carried on with the Killjoys. And then one day the Killjoys, they broke up. And they sort of, three of the guys who I wasn't getting on with just decided to leave. It was the day of a gig. And went, oh, we're not going. And I was devastated for a couple of weeks. And then I just thought, hang on a minute. I wasn't happy. I was thinking about this other band. And then I just thought, right, let's start. Myself and Kevin Archer, the first two we formed Dexys, we thought, right, OK, let's have a sit down, let's have a think. What do we want to do? And this time we thought, OK, we're not going to get people in and go, what do you want to do? We're going to go, this is what we're doing. You want to be part of it or not? So we had a blueprint this time. And that's what we did.
Who are, for you then, who are the soul holy trinity? Who are the people that really make your heart soar?
I have to say that I think Dexys, certainly me, made too much of that soul thing, of Dexys being soul, and I think we kind of narrowed ourselves there and bracketed ourselves in a negative way, really. And our music is soul, but it's other things as well. Do you know what I mean? It's a load of things, really. And we just said that because, you know what, in 1978... The NME weren't talking about soul, and it just sounded a good thing to say. It was like, yeah, we're a soul band. And it was like, wow. And but we look like this, you know. But soul, I mean, I've got to say Van. I have to say Van Morrison because, you know, he's not black, he's not American, but he oozes soul.
Why?
I don't know. He just, I saw an album, a cover picture of him, and I just thought, check shirt, long hair. Forget it, mate. Blue jeans, flares. Not going near it. And then I started, again, I just heard, I was in a wine bar one night and I just started to heard his music over and over and I just thought, wow. And I got into it. And his music showed me that music can just go somewhere else entirely, you know, somewhere that I'd never even thought was possible. But at the same time, you sort of recognise as somewhere that you know. Do you know what I mean? Mm. When you hear something, you know, it's like... It wakens something in you that it's sort of forgotten about. I mean, I think it works in ways that he doesn't even understand, I'm sure. Do you know what I mean? I think music comes through you, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that how you feel about it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. And I think once you start thinking about it and trying to take the credit for it, you know, the ego comes in and I think you're in trouble. And not that I don't have to fight that, because I do. But, yeah, I think that's it. Comes from somewhere else, you know.
Slim, slow, slide up. Horseshoe ride and white as snow. Slam, slow, slide up. Horseshoe ride and white as snow. Tell it everywhere you go. Saw you walking down by Ladbroke Grove this morning. Saw you walking down by Ladbroke Grove this morning. Catching pebbles for some sandy beach. You're out of reach. Saw you early this morning. Cadillac. but you're a brand new boy, and you can't like it. You're gone for something, and I know you won't be back. I know you're dying, baby, and I know you know it too. I know you're dying, and I know you know it too.
That's the beautiful Slim Slow Slider from Astral Weeks by Van Morrison. One of the greatest soul singers of all time, in the opinion of my guest this week on The First Time, Kevin Rowland.
This is Six Music.
This is BBC Radio Six Music.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's musical career. And that was Dance Dance, the first ever Dexys Midnight Runner single from 1979. And the man you hear singing it is my guest on The First Time this week, Kevin Rowland. First Dexys single, Dance Dance, yes?
Yes.
What do you remember about that coming out? Was that very much, this is what we have wanted to do, this is a statement of intent?
Massive disappointment. Massive disappointment.
I wasn't expecting you to say that.
No, well, what can I tell you? We recorded it. We were so happy to be recording it. Nervous as hell going into that studio. First time, you know, in a proper, real studio. And Bernard Rhodes and Mickey Foote producing. I was a little unsure about them, but they put us at ease. And I knew Mickey Foote was a good guy and he'd be all right. Went in, recorded it, was happy with it. We nailed it. You know, we got a good performance. When I left there, I thought, great. And then it was like, I'd be phoning up Bernard. Bernard, when are we going to mix a single? Because some of us definitely want to be there, want to be in the studio. And he was giving me all these, like, cryptic answers. And the long and the short of it was, after about, I don't know, a couple of months of me going, when are we going to mix it? He went, soon. Well, don't, you know, let us know. All right. About 2 months later, my manager, who was a friend of Bernard's, kind of knocked on my door one day and he went, oh, they had to mix the single. They got some free time the other night. There was no time to contact you, but they've mixed the single and they've got a test press in here. Well, even then, even with my little knowledge in the music business, I knew that from tape to test pressing was probably a couple of weeks. It wasn't 2 days, which is what I was being told.
Yeah.
And then I listened to it and I thought, oh my God, what did you do? It wasn't our sound. It's not a terrible record because the performance was good, but the mix is so bad. I mean, the brass is, it's just so wrong. It's just swamped in echo, as is my voice. And, you know, like, I played it to mates. What do you think? And they went, much better live, because they just ruined the production. They ruined it in the mix. So we make sure we got the next single right, Gino, which sounds like us.
In terms of the success that followed, obviously Come On Eileen and Young Soul Rebels, how do you think you dealt with that?
Terribly. really bad. I had absolutely no idea. Because I think, like we were talking about earlier, from a kid I had this idea that if I could just do that, I think all my problems will be solved. If I can just achieve that, all these other things that I've struggled with throughout my life will be okay. But it wasn't like that. You get a whole new set of problems on top. And if you're not well equipped to deal with anything like that, I think it is very difficult. And I found it very difficult. I mean, for a month I was like, this is great, you know, everyone coming up to me, this is fantastic. But then, you know, I felt an awful pressure as well, like a whole organization of people just developed around us overnight, and they're depending on us for their livelihood, and it just changed everything. And we're going to America, and it was, come here, do this. And I had no idea how to handle anything like that, and neither did the people around me. It must be said, the manager was, he owned a hairdressing shop that I worked in Birmingham, and he was a decent guy, so I said, look, come and do this. Anyway.
Rock steady rub. Oh, Gino.
You mentioned Bowie a lot.
I didn't get him at first because Starman, which was the first big single, didn't do anything for me, really. Mm-hmm. It sounded sub-Beatles. It sounded just like, oh, it did. I mean, if you listen to the vocal, Starman waiting in the sky, it just sounds like, to me, it sounds like Beatles and the harmonies. And also, summer of 72, that was, Virginia Plain came out. Now, to me, that sounded otherworldly. That sounded a big step forward.
Hell of a single.
Hell of a single, but more, it was just like, if you look at it in terms of the history of the music the last couple of years, that seemed like, where did that come from? Whereas Bowie, I couldn't see it as anything new. I couldn't, at that point. I'm straight with you now. I thought it was a bit old-fashioned looking.
Okay.
Really. And Roxy music would just look much cooler to me. Because that look had been around a while, that platforms. I mean, you know, like, Sweet and all them were wearing it. And I don't know. All right, he was taking it further, but it just didn't do it for me. And it didn't, to me, it didn't look attractive either, whereas Roxy did. So I was a Roxy fan. But somebody introduced me to Hunky Dory around 73, 74, got into that. But the thing that really got me was Young Americans when I saw that in 75 and I saw the look. And by the time I saw him in 75 with that little jacket and everything, I just thought, well, okay, now I'm with you. And because of that, I went back and I looked through Ziggy Stardust, and I thought, ah, it is a really good album. You know, I'm obviously a very great album. And then I was sort of, yeah. But it was Young Americans that got me into it.
Talk about Don't Stand Me Down, because sometimes it happens with records that they just don't have their moment when you think they're going to have their moment, and that's a record that has subsequently been revisited and everyone says what a fantastic piece of work it is. But at the time when it first came out, it kind of either missed its mark or it was fired at the wrong time, I don't quite know, or kind of didn't really connect in the way that now people love that record. They adore it.
Yeah.
Can you remember it sort of
I'm really happy
out?
That they do adore it,
yeah,
by the way.
I mean, can
I'm
you,
really
can
pleased
you,
about that. It's brilliant.
Can you sort of remember when it first came out and going, but this is great, and you're not, why don't you get this?
Do you know what? I didn't think like that, really. I was really happy with it when I finished it.
Mm.
But nobody was coming up saying... I mean, even the record company, they weren't saying... In fact, they were just going, this has cost a fortune. Da-da-da-da-da. And that's all they were saying to me. And that bloody song is 12 minutes long, and that's all they were saying. Nobody was saying, this is great.
Really?
No one. But we pissed them off quite a lot.
How?
During the making of it.
How?
Oh, well, way over budget. Not allowing them to release a single, which was stupid. Don't know why I got that idea into my head. I did. And my original idea was a 12-inch single. This is what she's like, full length. Mm. And that would have been good. And even the managing director of the company was going, give me something. Give me a 12-inch. I went, no. No. I think I was in a very odd place. I was disillusioned with what we talked about earlier, all the pop thing of that kind of around Touré. And I just felt like fighting. And also I was overconfident, actually. I was overconfident. I thought, people are just going to love this so much. We don't need to release a single. That's what I thought. I mean, you know, like the keyboard player, when we were making it, he says to me, so good, he went. And he was a good guy. It was Vincent Crane, RIP. He played with Atomic Rooster and people like that. And he says to me, this could be a Dark Side of the Moon for the 80s. And I really thought it could be, because it wasn't that it was uncommercial. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like it was...
Yeah,
know.
it's not an out-there record.
No, it's not. So it's just different. So I was overconfident. But you know what? When I look back, one of the things... The timing was weird, because maybe if we'd finished it a year earlier, it might have been different. But no, but think...
A year earlier, because it took that long to
well,
make...
Well, that was 3 years in between albums, which then was a long time. It isn't now, but then no one did that. Everybody released one a year, if not more, even. So by the time we came back, everything had changed. But Live Aid had just happened that summer. Ours came out in the September, October, 85.
I didn't put those two things together.
No, it changed everything. In fact, it was like, almost like the kind of aftermath, the come down, if you will, after Live Aid. It was all about these massive bands, and we weren't one of them.
I never thought about it like that, but you're right. The industry did, for every... Oh, it's reignited the career of Queen, or like U2 have got their chance to be stadium rockers.
Yeah.
A lot of bands that needed, that would have benefited from exposure, got steamrolled.
Well, I suppose so. It was just like, oh, Dexys. It seemed like that. And what are you doing? Oh, there's no single. Oh, right, okay.
And now everyone loves it.
And now everybody loves it. Which is great.
When did you first think, I've had it with Dexys, this is the end of the road?
I think deep down that was massive, when that album... They were just saying it was crazy, it was no good. So I think that was a big factor. I was well disillusioned after that, really. And I think me and Billy, even whilst when we were finishing it, we said, because it took about 2 years, and we said, I don't think I could do that again. And he was the same. I don't want to do that again. I don't want to go through that again. Because it was living it daily. It was like a film. Actually, it felt like making a film, because it had so many little strands everywhere, and I had notes everywhere, and it was, oh, what about that little bit and that little bit? I mean, we could see that it would all take shape, but it was such a lot of work getting it there.
I was thinking of a compromise when I saw the beauty in your eyes and hiding something in me, so I say so. You were always near to me. It's not.
reigniting the name, then bringing Dixies back. Because I can barely remember a time when a band has been so rapturously received.
The last album and the shows.
Yeah, the shows especially. What was it like stepping out on stage? What was that moment like when you first stepped out?
Terrifying. Really nervous. Because I hadn't done it for so many years. Completely out of practice. It's muscles. You have to, you know, you have to stretch them. But like anything. Like anything. Like hairdressing. I used to be a hairdresser. I remember, like, after about 3 years of not doing it, I tried to cut someone's hair and I was all... it was all wrong. You just lose it. But we did 8 weeks rehearsal before those four shows, yeah. That's the way you just looked was the way the accountant looked when I told him what we were going to do.
That's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work. Yeah, but it was a lot of work in that show. You know, it wasn't just playing the music. There was all sorts going on. Well, the way we looked at it was it's Dexy's name on the line here, reputation. I got too much ego to let that, you know, take a chance on that. So I was going to do everything I could to make sure they were good. Plus, you know, really, I just like doing things good. I'm not interested in doing them half measures at the moment. Touch wood, I stay that way because I'd rather slip my wrist than go through the motions, go and play the greatest hits at the O2, or maybe, I don't know if we could, but maybe we could. We could certainly play much bigger venues if we did a greatest hit show.
You must have got the offer, though.
Loads. Yeah, I've been tempted. But I know I'd hate myself and I wouldn't be able to do it.
I mean, the songs still stand up as great songs. You could conceivably say, do that, mortgage sorted, everyone's all right.
Yeah, but then what? I think I'd die. I'd die inside, I would. And also, you know, I think once you go down that route, I don't think anybody wants to hear your new album. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for us. We've had to resist so much temptation, constant. Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? And you just think, oh, if I do that, you know. Because when we're still having to challenge and fight people's perception of Dexys as an 80s band, you know.
Yeah.
That's what we're... Not everybody's, because there's a lot of people in the know who know what we're doing. To go on stage after all that work and to be what I believe is our best at that point, to do something that I felt was good, that's what it's all about. That is such a great feeling. Do you know what I mean? And to do something that's relevant to us now, not to be... Like I said, I'd slip my wrists rather than go and doing all them, hey, you remember us? you know, to be doing what we're doing now and have people loving it. And we didn't even need to do Come On Eileen. I mean, nobody complained on social media. Everybody left them shows going, it was great. Not to be arrogant, we felt it was great. Not because I'm saying I'm so talented. We worked hard and it worked. So can't ask for more than that. Totally blessed.
And what is the next step, then? What's the next thing you have your sights on?
Well, how long was the previous album? 26 years, wasn't it? So I think about 15 for the next one, I'd say.
You reckon?
Yeah, I'd say about 15. Maybe 14. Maybe 16. Around there somewhere.
Another couple of weeks of rehearsals before you take out on tour again.
Who knows?
Final question. What's the last track that we should play?
I can't think of anything.
What was the last song that you heard that made you cry, that made you feel something?
Yesterday, listening to Danny Boy. It was the Sinead O'Connor version. She sings it beautifully, but not a patch on the way my brother Pete. 18th of the 11th, 46 to 11th of the 11th, 2005. R.I.P. But not a patch on the way he sang it. He used to sing it so amazing. So anytime anybody sings that song, pretty much... Well, she did a very good version of it. I don't want to put it down. But anyway, Sinead O'Connor doing Danny Boy. Will that work?
That works for me, definitely.
All right.
Good to speak to you, man. Thank you very much.
All the best.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen. The summer's gone and all the flowers are falling. 'Tis you, 'tis you must go and I must bide. But come ye back.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Easier not to be what? Measure these things by your brains. I sank into Eden with you, alone in the church by and by. I'll read to you here, save your eyes. You'll need them, your boat is at sea. Your anchor is out, you've been swept away. And the greatest of teachers won't hesitate to leave you there. Things by your eyes long to be here by his resolve, alone in the church by and by, to cradle the baby in space.
Jukebox.
No!